Hello and welcome to Moving Kentucky Forward. I'm Bruce Maples, publisher of Forward Kentucky. A few weeks ago, I saw a graph from Boston that talked about their incidence of COVID infections, particularly Omicron, and the graph on the right just went straight up. It was a horrifying graph to look at, to think about that many infections spiking at that time. And then I looked again and realized that it came from their wastewater tracking system. I knew that there was something like that going on in Louisville. So I got in touch with Dr. Ted Smith, who's in charge of that effort. It appears that our waste, our poop, can talk to us and can tell us what's going on with infection in our community. So I wanted to ask Dr. Smith to come on board and share with us how that works and what he is seeing in Louisville. So here is Dr. Ted Smith. So I'm talking today with Dr. Ted Smith. He is the Associate Professor of Environmental Medicine at the University of Louisville. And as he says, for extra credit, he is also the director of the Center for Healthy Air, Water, and Soil, also at the University of Louisville. Dr. Smith, welcome to Moving Kentucky Forward.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So I wanted to talk with you about something that some people probably consider unpleasant, but is actually a very important topic. And that is the sampling work that you have been leading around sampling sewage for coronavirus. Without having to go into a huge amount of detail, can you tell us how that works?
Yeah, sure. So early in the pandemic, a team of researchers in Europe had discovered that when the virus was replicating in your body, it also was not only in the lungs, which people were very familiar with, but it was replicating in the GI tract. And so it turned out that, you know, you were also shedding virus through your feces, which meant that we could find other ways to figure out if people are infected, if live in a certain place. And those ways would be to actually go look at the sewage and count up copies of the virus that was shed through that pathway. And that's what we've been doing since July of 2020.
Only in the feces or also in the urine?
Very, very, very low levels sporadically in the urine. So it's not, urine's not a good target for this kind of virus.
Okay, so I haven't seen your sampling team outside my house. So I'm assuming you're not sampling individual houses. So at what level of granularity are you doing this sampling?
That's a great question. You know, this whole field, which is called wastewater-based epidemiology, is, while it's not brand new with the COVID pandemic, it is, it has picked up a lot of new investigators, a lot of new teams working on it, and you're not surprised. And they have been working at different levels of monitoring. And so you're right, we're not in your bathroom, you know, hooked up to your toilet. And we're not at your house going into the street, but there are many teams around the world who have been focused on congregate living facilities, senior living facilities. We have a project with the CDC in UK looking at senior living facilities, correctional facilities. So I have a project with the state looking at our state prisons, dormitories. A lot of the early work, because a lot of academics have the equipment, you know, they all went out to the dormitory that was, you know, kind of outside their office. So that's the smallest level of sampling that you'll see. And that's typically representative of, you know, maybe 100 to a couple hundred people. And then you can start stepping up. And, you know, the next step up is think of it as like a multi-neighborhood, you know, maybe a catchment area that holds, you know, addresses a population of 15, 20, 30,000 residents. And so pulling from there, you know, gives you a snapshot of that group of people, right? And then you can go all the way up to a wastewater treatment plant, which will handle hundreds of thousands of households in many cities, millions of households. And so, you know, that's the rough math is you're probably either working in a congregate living setting in a kind of a section of a community or kind of a whole community or a very large population.
Okay, let's get a little more technical. So I'm imagining some sort of, as you said, a catchment, some sort of sewage pipe. Most of us have not looked at sewage and have no idea what it looks like or runs like. But so you take the top off, you know, and what do you do? Do you put a bottle down in there and catch some and take it back to the lab, or do you actually test it there?
So there's no testing in the field to answer that question, but methods vary. The most common method is something called composite sampling, where you take a device that is designed, you put a tube, you open that manhole, you put a tube down that manhole, and every 15 minutes, it grabs 100 milliliters of what's flowing through that pipe. Okay. And it does that for 24 hours. So what it deposits in a sample container is a 24 hour composite sample of what went through that pipe. And what goes through that pipe, as you said, most people don't know. So for the most part, our sanitary sewer system, you know, was designed to carry human waste, right? But it was also designed to carry other kinds of discharges, right? So there's industrial discharges, there's other, you know, other kinds of commercial facilities that use the sanitary sewer system. And then because our city is so old, you know, inside the Waterston Expressway, we have combined sewers. So, you know, the stormwater mixes with human waste.
Right.
And, you know, the wastewater treatment plant has to, you know, try to keep up with keeping it all cleaned up, and which is a very big problem. So bottom line is we're taking a composite sample of 24 hours. There are people that do what they're called grab samples. You dip a bucket in and you take the, you might guess that that's a really unreliable sample because it's just what came by that moment. And then there are those. Stanford University really leads this charge, you know, focused on when it gets to the wastewater treatment plant, the first thing that happens is the solids, which we all recognize as feces, the solids settle out in a tank. And what they do is they go take those solids, they take a scoop of that, and then they go analyze that. And, you know, so there's different methods and, you know, they have different kinds of benefits.
And so then you've got this sample. You take it back to a lab, I assume, at the university.
Yep.
And you, how do you test for the presence of coronavirus?
Sure. And I'll just modify it. We did take it back to our lab early on, right? Because we have the equipment and the know-how. We have been working here in Louisville with a company called Eurofins, Eurofins Genomics. They moved here because of UPS. They do a lot of pathogen testing for the USDA. They're the largest lab for the USDA. And we have been working closely to try to help them develop this as an ongoing capability. Because our researchers want to do research. They don't want to process wastewater every week, right? And get behind in their own careers, right? So we are working to sort of translate this. And we're also working with the state health lab to give help them establish that capability at the state's health lab. So, but you're right. So it comes back to our lab. We use exactly the same technologies that the nasal pharyngeal swabs that you're familiar with use, which is PCR based amplification. So essentially we take the sample that came out of the sewer, we filter it. So we get all the big debris out, right? There's pieces of toilet paper. There's, you know, there's stuff in the sewage, right? That isn't just the feces. And we filter that. And then we concentrate it. We centrifuge it. We get to a little pellet essentially of the solids that are in that, what otherwise does look like kind of milky water. We get a solid pellet, and then we use the PCR technology to essentially amplify the RNA that's in that pellet, and then we essentially run it against primers and probes that determine which genes are present. And those primers and probes are the same ones that we use for clinical samples. So We're doing the same thing that we would do if it was a clinical swab. We're doing with a wastewater sample, and we are able to then count up the number of genes, copies of these genes that are only associated with SARS-CoV-2 virus. And so then we can quantify how many copies of the gene are in that sample per liter of sample. And that's what we do. And then we report that as, you can think of it as abundance, like how much virus was present in that sample.
Okay, one more sort of introductory question. You're doing this in Louisville. Is any of this being done anywhere else in the state?
There's a team at the University of Kentucky that's working. They got a large NIH grant to do work in Appalachia. And so there's an interesting collection of different kinds of sampling that needs to be done in communities that don't have big centralized sewage systems. So they're mm-hmm. they're leading the charge on, think of it as rural challenges for sampling. And then the state has a pretty significant contract to look at wastewater in manufacturing and agricultural settings. And so our three efforts in the state, you know, we're very focused on urban and corrections, a little bit with nursing homes, UK nursing homes and rural, and then the state lab itself is focused on some of these occupational settings. So there are many things going on here in the Commonwealth.
Okay, now we've sort of set the table. Now let's get to the news. I reached out to you because I saw a graph from a similar effort in Boston. And the graph just scared the pee out of me, not to be too weird with that.
And like I said, I'm not going to find anything in pee, so you can have that scared out.
That's not have it scared, that's right. So the graph just was, to me, horrifying. So what are you finding over the last, say, 2 months in Louisville?
Let me add one more piece to the story we told in setting the table. So I told you the story of us counting copies of the SARS virus in February of 2021, when we knew that mutations were going to be perhaps the new currency, right? The new thing that everybody was going to really, because we're really concerned about vaccine escape, right? Like if we get a variant that the vaccine doesn't protect against, it's a pretty significant problem for us, mm-hmm. right, as a society, right? So it's rightful that we think now about like, okay, the you know, we know that there's a lot of infection, it comes in waves, and, you know, we got a testing infrastructure. The new problem in last year around this time was, how will we keep track of these variants? And we were one of the first communities in the world to figure out how to sequence the viral copies that we found. And the one piece that we left out of the last narrative was, we're shedding into the feces, into that sewer system, fragments of the genome. So people will ask me, you know, well, can I get infected, you know, from feces, right? I mean, it's an important question to know the answer to. And the answer is no, you can't get infected from what you find in the sewage. So don't worry about, there's lots of reasons to worry about being around sewage. SARS-CoV-2, COVID isn't one of them. So we are getting pieces, and I describe it as we actually get jigsaw puzzle pieces, and these are very big jigsaw puzzles, and there are many, many different kinds of many different pictures in the jigsaw puzzles, right? And I have to figure out from the pieces which puzzle they go to. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's how we do the genomic sequencing of the wastewater. We go mm-hmm. looking for all these mutations, and then we statistically determine what they're most likely associated with. If I had the full sample that I would have from your nose, I would have a whole long read. I would have the whole genome of the virus. I don't get that luxury in the wastewater, so I'm piecing it together. We came up with a method for doing that in very short order. Like, we can turn around genomic sequencing in 2 days at our lab at U of L. And, you know, when we started doing that work, you know, it really garnered a lot of attention, because that has become the important question. So when you looked at the Boston Globe story of, you know, kind of this meteoric growth, you know, we all intuitively knew that that was the Omicron surge. But the only way you would know it was the Omicron surge is if you were looking for the genes that are associated with Omicron. Mm-hmm. And so we have been doing that work since February every week. And so part A to the answer to your question is, yeah, we saw a really large growth in the amount of virus in our community. And we also can tell you it's virtually all Omicron at this point in time. We found Omicron in the wastewater before a clinical sample was discovered in Jefferson County. So we were ahead of the discovery of it by the usual method. You would figure out where the variants were. Wastewater has that kind of value. So we called the governor's office. In the governor's press briefing, he said, we have it up in Northern Kentucky, we have it in Fayette County, and I hear that it's in the wastewater in Louisville. That's exactly what he said. Sure. And so, this is, for us, it's all part of the work. So we're counting it up and we're trying to figure out what's behind it. Because if there was some new thing that was becoming abundant, we'll probably see it in the wastewater first here. And so, we think that it's a really good sentinel approach for doing genomic, they call it genomic surveillance, but, trying to keep on top of what's going on. By the way, we see thousands of variants, right? So the world has been trained to think, oh, we had Delta, and before that we had, Beta, and we had Alpha, now we're going to have Pi next. I mean, as if it's as simple as there's a couple of different flavors of this. There are thousands and thousands of flavors of the wild type of this thing mutating all the time, but only certain of them, as we figured out, catch enough, to become something we need to keep track of. So sorry for that really long answer, but we are seeing dramatic growth. It hasn't slowed down. These are the highest levels we've seen in the wastewater since we started this work.
Wow.
And it all makes sense, right? We have, all the other testing data that we have as a community, we see, positivity rate in our community is in the, sort of 30%. I mean, it's much higher than it's ever been. So we know there's a whole lot of people that are infected. And at this point, the wastewater's in some levels redundant with what we know from all of these other sources.
Well, okay, let me ask you a question. I don't want you to necessarily identify the area or the neighborhood, but do you see differences across the city? Are there some parts of the city that are worse or better than others?
Absolutely. When we started this work, we're one of a couple of cities in the U.S. that decided to brave below wastewater treatment plants. One thing you should know about wastewater treatment plants is it's a lot easier to get a sample from a wastewater treatment plant. You can imagine, if you will, a tap handle like at a bar. You just walk up and you pull the tap and you load the sample jar up, and now you've got a sample. It's kind of that. I mean, they're constantly, for regulatory reasons, they're constantly doing composite sampling, and so it's as simple as pulling a tap handle at a wastewater treatment plant. Opening up a manhole, that requires a certain kind of bravery. And, MSD's been a partner the whole time. And of course, they know their infrastructure better than anybody. And, we worked with them to figure out which locations in the community would help us understand the question you raise, which is, are there places that are kind of more challenged than others? And the answer is yes. And we've been doing this. I mean, it's really the whole reason we set out to do this inside the geography of Jefferson County. So we have 12 catchment areas that are below the wastewater treatment level. And that means, whole collections of neighborhoods. So, it's not that we have a one neighborhood. Like, we don't have the Highlands, and we don't have, just Chickasaw or whatever. We have call it sort of like regions, and they vary in size. And I will tell you the answer is, it tracks perfectly with vaccination coverage. So the areas of highest infection have the lowest vaccination. And those areas, you can go to the city's website and you can see what vaccination coverage looks like in Louisville. And it is Southwest, West, South Central Louisville have the lowest vaccination coverage. We regularly have the highest concentrations of virus all the time, regularly. Like, I don't have to look at this week's report, which I'll get tomorrow. I don't have to look at it to know where the top three places are. I mean, I already know where they are, and I'll look at the report and it will say that's where they are. And it's hard, to figure out what you do with that information. So it can be a curiosity, like, are there differences? You know, is the sort of northeast part of Jefferson County less infected? The answer is yes, you know, but what would you do with that information? And that turns out to be a much harder problem because, as you know, the drum has been beating on the importance of vaccination, and that drumbeat has been heard in some places more than others. And so that's actually still the answer, right? So if I can tell you there's good reason, this is one of the reasons you should get vaccinated, is, you know, you'll help keep the burden of this disease lower in your community. And I have empirical evidence that that's true.
So let me ask one other question. You talked about breaking up, about the fact that you get puzzle pieces and that you saw the Omicron variant. I'm assuming what you get is you get like a whole bunch of puzzle pieces, but some of them are, well, we got one or two of these, but this one we got 200 of. So we need to look at that. So I'm wondering, and you said you were one of the first detection systems to see Omicron and say, okay, here's this thing coming.
In Louisville, I mean, in Kentucky, I want to be clear, in Kentucky, we identified it first in wastewater in Louisville.
Okay.
Right. So right. We weren't the first in the world to find, you know, Omicron in wastewater. I mean, you know, lots of other researchers are on this problem. So it's a big group activity.
But is it possible, or do you have fail-safe put in, that while you are counting up these Omicrons over here, that there's, you know, some other variant that's going on that you're not looking for? How do you see that if it happens?
Yeah. So it's a great question. So the reason that we launched this genomic sequencing work wasn't to find any one variant. It was to sequence everything. So we have terabytes of data every week of all of the gene dropouts, additions, deletions, you know, all across the entire genome. We keep track of all of them. And we bring them together when there's published, you know, there's a big genomics database called GISAID. We go to GISAID and we look at the database of all the known and reported clinical sequences and start to stitch together the ones that look like existing ones that have been identified. And then we keep a full inventory of all of the other mutations, right? So we have thousands and thousands and thousands in our library going back to February of 21 of all the different versions of SARS that we've seen in our community. And when the CDC decides that one of those other ones of the thousands that we've identified is becoming clinically relevant, you know, they call it a variant of interest at that point in time. And if that continues to be seen clinically, people that are coming in with symptoms and having problems, there are other, you know, whatever challenges, they'll say, oh gosh, there's enough mutations here to the spike protein that, you know, we really need to put this on a list because some of our therapies might not be effective against this. Then they call it a variant of concern, which Omicron is a variant of concern because of the mutations it has. That is not to say that there aren't a lot of other scary looking mutations out there, and there sure are. It's the good news is none of them have achieved critical mass, right? It may be just in one person, right? And you know, that mutation doesn't successfully get transmitted to another person. And so that happens all the time. And that's why you'd want to do this. So we have a giant library. I would say the value of our work isn't that we found Omicron. The value of our work is that we found all the other variants that we're going to see. I believe we found them all. And whether any of them become viable and important, we'll be able to look back in time and say, when did I first see that in Louisville? Hmm. We've done this before. I mean, before Delta was declared a variant of concern, we had it in our community. But of course, it wasn't a thing to know about. And then when suddenly the CDC said, oh, there's this strain, because of our technology, we were able to say, well, gosh, I saw that in Newburgh in March, you know, and then right. We saw it again in June down in South Central. I mean, that's the beauty of this approach, is that we're not just chasing. It's not like software viruses where you're only as good as the last version that the coders figured out. It's looking at the whole spectrum, and it's a very, very powerful thing.
So I have two other questions. I mean, I could really, because I love science, I could go on about this for a long time, but let me ask you two questions. One, is there any testing of this of animal feces to see if there is a possibility that COVID could be cross-species transmitted?
It's a really good question. So the work in other species has been limited to, you know, kind of the upper respiratory sampling. We've had a brief exchange with the state's veterinarian about white-tailed deer, because it's now been established that white-tailed deer can be a reservoir, and they are a reservoir for SARS. But we haven't taken it to that next step of, you know, does this method of surveillance have any use in that particular situation, right? And I don't know. Remember, we have the luxury of, we're living at the end of sanitary sewer pipes, right? And the deer and the animals in the zoo and all that, like, it's a different story, you know, for these other organisms. And so it's, I'm excited to see what can be done. Clearly, we need to understand these other animal reservoirs and the role of the larger ecology. But, you know, we just haven't had the luxury, you know, given all the firefighting that we've been doing in this pandemic, to mm-hmm. work on those next level questions.
I was specifically thinking about, and I can't think of the term I want, corporate farming or corporate production farming. I had a friend who was a hog farmer. And we talked about the fact that keeping hogs in pens all in one building with all the sewage and everything led to more disease. So I was thinking, okay, there's a place where you could get a sample fairly.
Yeah, easy. I actually think that's one of the reasons the state has an FDA grant to look at food production facilities. I don't know that they went out and said that. I mean, I think there's an occupational lens that you can apply, right? Because that's a little bit like the original wet market scenario in Wuhan. It was, you know, this thing jumped, right, theoretically from, you know, this species, right, this other species to humans. And the places where that kind of jumping would happen would be places where there was this milieu and constant teaming and right. And so, you're certainly wise for putting that on the table. But I think we currently lack, I think, the will to, you know, bring that kind of science into those settings. And the USDA, you know, is I think largely the regulator there. And, you know, I don't think they've been part of the public health kind of picture in the way that, say, the CDC or others have been.
I think it would be interesting for somebody to go after that, but I understand what you're saying.
Well, and it's a good research question, right? We should take the shotgun method of sequencing that, you know, and take a look at everything that you see in pig effluent, right? And, you know, it would be interesting to see, right, what you would find.
So my last question is there anything that you wanted me to ask you that I didn't, or anything you wanted to share or talk about that we haven't covered?
Well, I mean, I think, the nagging question that some people bring, and it's a very good one, is this ethics issue. So you opened with, you know, you're not surveilling my toilet, right? I mean, like, true. But there are people on the sort of spectrum, on the ideological spectrum, you know, who would say, you know, you're spying on me, right? Don't do that. I don't care if there's a public health emergency, you know, don't do that. And I think we shouldn't run away from ethics questions. We shouldn't. We should steer into them, and we should own them. And so, you know, just so you know, from my perspective, this will be a category of health monitoring. It will be. I mean, there's been so much money spent on it, so many different efforts involved. And, you know, I'm working closely with a couple of federal agencies on what an enduring capability would be. How do we protect ourselves from pathogens in the future? Or how do we understand population health risk differently? And all those things. I see this coming. And so therefore, it's not just all the crazy things we did during COVID. I think there's a bigger community conversation to be had with the American public. And it is, let's be transparent about this. Let's set limits, right? So we shouldn't be pulling your DNA, right? We should agree. We're not looking for human DNA ever, right? And that should be a rule. I have issues with some of my colleagues who were in this field before COVID, who were looking for illicit drug use. And, you know, I think the whole ethical conversation on looking for, you know, fentanyl and oxycodone, all these kinds of things, I think it can stigmatize neighborhoods, right? And I think if it's going to stigmatize neighborhoods, it creates, it mixes up the value proposition, right? So if I said, well, it's good for law enforcement and it's good for public health, you know, maybe somebody will say, well, gosh, you know, like we don't need any more stigma in many of our neighborhoods. Like, so let's stop doing stuff like this. And then if it doesn't protect us from the next thing, you know, I'll say, because we weren't responsible about how we use the tool. It's just like nuclear power or whatever. I mean, like there's lots of good and bad applications of this capability. And so it could be a whole nother show for you, but you know, I welcome it. I mean, I think we should be talking about it. Personally, I feel very good about the boundaries we've set up for what we're doing, as anonymous as, you know, like nobody's privacy is being violated. But I appreciate the sensitivity to the issue. It's important.
That's an excellent point. And another thing that we need to discuss as a community and maybe even as a civilization. Dr. Ted Smith, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for being able to take a complex process and break it down for us so we can all understand it. And let's close by saying, if somebody wanted to go see reports, if they wanted to see a graph like the Boston graph that I saw, where would they go to do that?
I would Google the Envirome Institute and Co-Immunity Project, and I can send you a note. Maybe you can put it in with the show, a link that take you to our dashboard.
Okay. Envirome, Envirome.
Yep. What's a cheeky take on, we're not the genome, we're the Envirome, we're the other guys.
Right. Thank you so much for your time and take care.
Hey, thank you so much. You stay well.
That was Dr. Ted Smith of the University of Louisville, who, in addition to his regular teaching duties as a professor there, is in charge of the wastewater monitoring system looking for coronavirus in Louisville. We really want to thank him for his time and for his work and expertise in leading that effort. It's really groundbreaking, and as he said, it may become something that we do for a lot of reasons across the country. So thanks again to Dr. Smith. I want to make a note about this podcast. I was trying to keep it at one per week, but I realized that there are some news things that are breaking more frequently than that. And so rather than trying to keep to a regular release schedule, I'm basically lining up interviews whenever there is something newsworthy to talk about. Our next podcast, for example, will be with Dr. Josh Douglas, and we will talk about redistricting. So if you subscribe to the podcast, or if you are on our website regularly where we post them as well, you'll be able to catch them when they come along. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you in the next podcast.